91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Job markets have never been more volatile. Today's technology blur and globalization creates and destroys jobs and careers in a flash. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Today's careers seldom happen on a smooth path, but usually move through many phases. People must be prepared to adapt and move on, perhaps multiple times, unlike our parents and grandparents. They may have stayed with one company for an entire working life. We'll speak with multimedia journalist and researcher Farai Chidea. She's written about the new face of employment in her book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. Of course, we'll be taking your calls. That's next, after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. While the majority of presidential candidates lobby for votes in Indiana ahead of tomorrow's primary, the Democratic and Republican frontrunners are competing for votes in Appalachia. Hillary Clinton meets today with the head of a local steelworkers union and retired mine workers in West Virginia, Kentucky, and Ohio. She has pledged $30 billion in aid for economically depressed areas that depend on coal, but she's still holding to a plan to move the country away from coal toward alternative energy sources. Clinton is expected to have a tough time winning over fans of Donald Trump, who has promised to keep coal mining communities in business and resist trade deals that he says hurt American jobs. Virginia Republicans say they are preparing to sue the state's Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe, over his recent order to restore voting rights to more than 200,000 felons. More on this from NPR's Pam Fessler.
McAuliffe's move is a, quote, overreach by the executive branch. According to state GOP lawmakers, they announced that they've hired a top Republican attorney, Charles Cooper, to explore the legal options. Cooper was assistant attorney general in the Reagan administration. Republicans say the governor exceeded his authority by granting a blanket order allowing felons to vote if they've completed their sentences, probation, and parole. Previous governors restored those rights on a case-by-case basis. Virginia could be a pivotal state in the November elections. Republicans accuse McAuliffe of trying to increase Democratic votes, something the governor strongly denies. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
The governor of Michigan warns that Detroit's public school teachers are hurting students and themselves in protesting a severe funding shortfall by calling out sick today. Governor Rick Snyder says it certainly doesn't help those who are trying to get the legislature to approve a $720 million rescue package for Detroit's school district. The teachers launched a sick out after learning that the city may not be able to pay its teachers after June 30th. Secretary of State John Kerry says he's discussing several proposals to revive a ceasefire in Syria. NPR's Michelle Kellerman says Kerry has met with the UN envoy in Geneva.
Kerry says he's working on ways to restore calm around Aleppo, where three health clinics have been hit in recent airstrikes.
The regime has clearly indicated a willingness over a period of time now to attack first responders, to attack healthcare workers and rescuers.
And those attacks, he says, have to stop. Secretary Kerry is also again urging Syria to allow aid workers to reach all those in need. The U.S. has been working on plans for safe zones in Aleppo, but needs Russia's backing for that. Kerry spoke by phone to his Russian counterpart and says the U.N. envoy, Stephane de Mistura, is heading to Moscow this week. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow is up 78 points. This is NPR News.
From the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald, I'm Christine DiMatte. A Hollywood man is in custody today after trying to carry out an explosive attack on an Aventura synagogue. 40-year-old James Medina is accused of attempting to use what's being called a weapon of mass destruction to blow up the Aventura Turnberry Jewish Center during services on Friday. Medina is being held in the Federal Detention Center in downtown Miami and is expected to have his first court appearance this afternoon. He was portrayed by law enforcement officials as being anti-Semitic, and law enforcement says that might have been a factor in his motivation to try to carry out the plot. FBI agents learned about Medina's plans from confidential sources and were able to thwart them on Friday evening. The Miami U.S. Attorney's Office says more information on this arrest will be made available this afternoon. Well, the first United States cruise ship in nearly 40 years has crossed the Florida Straits from Miami and docked in Havana. This restarts commercial travel on waters that served as a stage for a half century of Cold War hostility. Carnival Cruise Line's Fathom Adonia took to sea on its historic voyage yesterday. Passenger Carrie Rebicki says she's excited to be able to see Cuba.
There's a lot of controversy. Some of my friends thought I was foolish, but something I wanted to always do.
Carnival CEO Arnold Donald says the cruise will open up new opportunities for the United States and for Cuba.
To be a part of truly making history and preparing for an even more positive future for everyone is one of the greatest honors any company can have.
So what's on the agenda? Well, the passengers will visit many of the same places a typical tourist might, the Plaza de la Revolución, the Colón Cemetery, and the National Fine Arts Museum. The Adonia became the first U.S. cruise ship in Havana since President Jimmy Carter eliminated virtually all restrictions of U.S. travel to Cuba in the late 1970s. Now, travel limits were restored after Carter left office, and U.S. cruises to Cuba only became possible again after Presidents Barack Obama and Raul Castro agreed to normalize U.S.-Cuba relations. That was in December 2014. This is WLRN Miami Herald News. I'm Christine DiMattei.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Manhattan. The exhibition Edgar Degas, A Strange New Beauty, is on view. More information and tickets at MoMA.org. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman.
Welcome back, Bonnie Berman.
Thank you. It's fun and good to be here. So this hour we visit with author, multimedia journalist, researcher, and radio host Farai Chidea. She's a familiar voice to public radio listeners. She's a novelist, has been a TV network reporter and political analyst as well, and has earned numerous journalism and social activism awards.
You could say she has a slash career, and we'll find out more about that label. Her latest book is The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. Farai Chidea joins us now from NPR New York. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Joseph. Thanks, Bonnie.
Welcome to you. Glad to have you with us. So many of our listeners undoubtedly remember you as the host of NPR's former program, News and Notes. So I'd kind of like to begin there, as you do in your book. Explain what was going on in your life when you were hosting News and Notes and what happened.
Well, I really loved hosting the show as a job, and I got so much out of the community, but I was not well equipped to deal with some of the things like, you know, the really early hours that I had to work for a while. And I'm used to making sacrifices for work, and, you know, I still do, but I realized that certain things like, you know, going to work at 4 a.m. just didn't really suit how my body worked. And I think everyone's individual. And as the, you know, the impetus for this book was not my own personal experience, but as I started writing the book, basically out of, you know, a desire to explore the economy, I also started thinking, well, what about us as human beings? You know, each of us is individual. You know, everyone has the capacity to do different things in different ways. And one of the things I really try to stress in this book is that you have to look out for yourself and your own personal health and well-being as you navigate what is a very complex, you know, labor economy right now.
Well, so you were able to recognize that there were things that weren't good for your physical health and the stress and everything and getting up early.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sure I've compressed it a bit too much, but I found myself, you know, I'm a chronic insomniac. I have been since I was a kid, and I found that working the you know, schedule where I had to be in the office at 4 a.m. just didn't work with my body. But more importantly, I began to just sort of take a holistic look at where work fit in my life, because I was really raised, you know, in a working class Baltimore family to be someone who achieved and did well. And that's great. But, you know, life has to be a synergy between your personal pursuits and your professional pursuits. And so I found that I was really kind of letting go of my, my weight, my health, my exercise routines. It's a pretty common story.
Right.
But, you know, I think that it's important not to say, well, I can't do a job because it's taxing. But it's important to also say, what can I do if I'm working a job that I find particularly taxing in its hours or in its you know, its travel demands or whatever? What can I do to take care of myself? Because otherwise, you can't thrive in that job.
You distinguish between hopscotch careers and slash careers. You've had a slash career, or you are experiencing a slash career presently. Distinguish between them.
Yeah, so the whole point of the book is that I look at the difference between today's careers and the traditional career, which is like, you know, the linear career where you get in a field and you stay in it as long as you can. And that's what's considered success, is like, do you have longevity? Can you get your gold watch? Whereas today, there's some people who are going to have that linear career, but the average length of employment is 4.4 years. So many people won't. And the hopscotch career is where you work one full-time job and you move around from field to field. And the slash career, which I'm doing now, is I'm a professor slash writer. And so, you know, you do a couple things at once and you try to balance the needs of them. And there's no such thing as perfection in anything in life, but you have to say, how can I do a couple things at once and do them well without cheating myself or other people in my life or the companies? Because it doesn't work if you find yourself cutting corners.
Usually analysis of multitasking says that it's a myth.
Yeah. I mean, I do think multitasking is a myth. Your brain actually sort of has this micro ability to switch back and forth between tasks, and you fool yourself that it's multitasking when actually it's just like very rapid monotasking. And there's that whole concept of flow, which is that it takes about 3 hours for you to be really in the zone and really get a big thing done. You can get a lot of small things done in a small amount of time, but to get, you know, a big concept done for a research paper or get something done for planning classroom notes for a class, you need a little bit of unbroken time. And so I think that one of the successful approaches to having a slash career is saying, when is it okay for me to switch back and forth between tasks? And when do I need to really just carve out time to focus on one thing? Just because you do more than one thing as a job doesn't mean that you need to do more than one thing at once all the time. In fact, that's kind of a recipe for disaster.
Right. You know, I was thinking you just said, so I want to go back to that the average lifespan of a job today is 4.5 years, which is pretty remarkable,
yep.
Which I didn't know until I read your book. But I think I was thinking another important point in our time versus the old days or whatever it's called. I mean, there are still people who do have those linear careers, as you say. But one used to think of an employer, I think, as a caretaker. So one would invest in their job, the employee would invest in their job, and in turn, the employer would invest in their employees, even down to taking care of their health insurance, their retirements, everything like that, and how that has changed so dramatically and how we have to adapt to that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that what I talk about is psychological self-employment, that no matter whether you have one employer, two, three, or zero, you have to have an attitude of psychological self-employment, which means, okay, I'm the boss of me, and for
right.
better or worse, I have to figure out what my long-term strategy is. And I have many different examples from different types of people in the book. That's one of the reasons I wrote this book, was to kind of surface the wisdom we have among ourselves. And so one person I spoke to is someone who's had 14 jobs in 25 years, not by choice, but partially in these days. You know, it's a woman who has said, well, I will leave companies that are struggling before they crash and burn. And that's what she personally has decided to do to protect herself a bit. But, you know, one of the things that she says is that, you know, you have to still give, even if you know that your time is limited at a company, you have to still give 110% and you have to create temporary community. Because one of the things we get out of work is that, you know, we have coworkers, we celebrate each other's birthdays. Life is better when we treat people who we work with well. And so it's not about saying, well, everything's disposable. It's about saying, well, it's more maybe an analogy is like camping. You want to leave a place better than when you found it. You know, even if you don't stay there forever,
right,
you actually want to make it better.
When you call this the age of disruption, are you referring to not only all the economic forces and the globalization and the technological stuff that's changed the landscape, but also it's really seems to be an age of disruption spiritually and psychologically, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that so this book came out of reporting on politics. So I did a big project in 2010 that aired on a number of public radio stations about, you know, kind of the economy and the midterm elections in 2010. And in many ways, I think it's a precursor to the elections in 2016, where we're seeing a lot of resentment over the promises of America that the country doesn't seem to be able to fulfill for people, you know, the promise that your children will live better than you have. And so when I think about disruption, there's this term disruptive innovation, which deals with automation and you know, many of the economic factors. But there is, as you say, this kind of spiritual and personal disruption where people are now saying, well, if part of the ethos of America is work as hard as you can and do as well as you can, and I'm working as hard as I can, but I'm not doing that well. Mm-hmm. Does that make me a failure? Does that make America a failure? What's going on? And people are starting to question their lives.
When did it really begin to proliferate this mentality of we're all screwed?
Well, you know, I think that in 2010, I saw a lot of confusion because that was, you know, the Great Recession technically ended in 2009. But of course, that doesn't really reflect the realities because even today, you still have most people only getting back to wages that they had 10 years ago. You know, there was a dip in real wages and now we've kind of come back to the baseline. But that doesn't mean that people have been gaining over the past decade. They've just been fighting their way out of a hole. And so I think in 2010, there was a sense of kind of shock that the economy was not producing the same yields for everyday working people that it did before. And now there's a resentment that, okay, well, I know that things didn't go so well for a while, but why haven't they gotten better? And are things always going to be this way? And there's also just, you know, looking at household expenses, there's certain things like the cost of food that have remained relatively reasonable for the most part, and then other things like the cost of a college education that have just kind of spiraled out of control. And so certain things that make up what people think of as the middle class dream, which is, you know, your kids can go to college, now are beginning to seem, if not unattainable, at least a little tricky. Like, well, it's great if my kids go to college, but if they come out with $80,000 in debt, does that mean that they've still succeeded? And so these are the kinds of questions people are asking themselves.
We're speaking with Farai Jadeja. She's an award-winning author, political journalist, researcher, cultural analyst, and educator. And her latest book is The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back. We'll open the phones, and we'll speak more with Farai. Stay with us.
Jordan was an at-risk middle schooler who participates in the Harmony program thanks to funding by the Children's Services Council of Broward County. Harmony works with children struggling with behavior issues and academic performance. Thanks to Harmony, Jordan says that he is really proud of himself, that he changed his past, and that now his home is happy, his family is happy, and he is happy. Details at cscbroward.org. Our focus is our children.
Make it a very special Mother's Day for the mom in your life with a beautiful arrangement of flowers from Field of Flowers. And every donation supports the programs you value on WLRN. For more, visit WLRN.org.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. W. Kamau Bell is hitting the road in a new travel show called United Shades of America. Next time on Q, the comedian will tell us about his voyages into racist subcultures, including the Ku Klux Klan. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tune in to the Q this evening, starting at 8 o'clock.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Farai Chidea. We're talking about her book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. As promised, if you'd like to join in the program, you're certainly welcome. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. Farai, tell us about the work-life, quote, sweet spot.
Yeah, well, I mean, the work-life sweet spot is really where you have optimized what it is that you need to earn with what it is that you need to do for yourself and for your family. And I have to say, having written this book, the number one group of people who I've had the most complex discussions with are women who are balancing childcare and work. Particularly those who have kind of ramped down for a while to take care of children and are now going back into the workplace full strength, full time. And there's such a, it certainly is true for men as well, but I think that for many reasons women are, asked to make the most domestic-minded decisions when they have jobs, And I've had such, I spoke to a group of women who had all sorts of really complicated emotional math, like when is it okay to work in front of your children? Does that mean that you're with them, or does that mean that you're ignoring them if you're working from home? Working from home seems great, but if you're working from home and you're not really emotionally present for your kids, is that better or worse than just being away and out of sight, out of mind? And so the work-life sweet spot is different for everyone, and it's also different with phases of life. There's been many phases in my life where I've been really happily globetrotting and, running around the universe and having a great time, and now that I myself am in the pipeline to adopt a child, I have to think very clearly that I have to work at a job that keeps me in one place. And I'm not even at that finish line yet where I have a child, but I already knew that I had to sort of engineer my life in order to do something that kept me in one place.
And that's what you're doing now.
Absolutely.
I was thinking about this. For many, this hopscotch career or this slash career, it could be a positive thing that a job lifespan is 4.5 years, and we have to keep reinventing ourselves and changing with the times. But do you think that's true for everybody, or just, people under 30? I mean, is that good for baby boomers too, who are still in the workforce?
Well, it's not a matter of good for. It's really a matter of what is your reality. Because
right.
There are people who definitely, people who are baby boomers, people who are Gen Xers, and even people who are millennials who will have a traditional linear career. Like, let's say you get a certain type of engineering degree and you just work your way through, a career ladder within that field of engineering. You may be able to really have a very traditional career. But for many more people, entire fields will disappear. Like, think about all of the people who worked in the landline phone industry. Mm. It's not as if there's no landline phones, but the industry has shrunk, and the mobile industry has grown. And, technology and globalization are constantly reshaping what we do. And even with things like teaching, a lot of my family are teachers on the K-12 level. And with the advent of standardized testing, the advent of technology tools in the classroom, teaching is very different than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So also fields reinvent themselves. And so really the reason I wrote this book, the reason I wrote The Episodic Career, is because I saw a lot of people suffering because they kept telling themselves that they were bad or failed or wrong for not succeeding in the workplace. And a lot of times what I saw was instead people making assumptions about what work was today that simply are not true. It's not true, for the most part, that people will be able to keep a job for 25 years or longer or even stay in the same field. There's exceptions to that. But if your mindset is, generally speaking, that I'm going to be able to stay where I am, you're in for a rude surprise. And so part of what I'm trying to do is get people into a mindset where we can take better care of ourselves, whether that means emotionally, financially. And also some of it has to do... you know, at this point, I teach at NYU, and I'm also a senior writer at 538, which is a data journalism site, and I'm doing a big piece on retirement. And as people switch jobs more often, it becomes very important to have that psychological self-employment mindset, not just about, you know, your day-to-day work, but also your retirement. Right. Because if you keep switching jobs, you're in control of your retirement. You can't wait for your pension to vest at any one place. You might have a pension, but it won't be necessarily the same kind of pension you would have if you had been at a place for 20 years. There's a lot of very practical decisions that are being demanded of us that weren't being demanded, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. And we just have to make ourselves prepared.
Well, Joe wants to talk about that matrix, your tool that you developed. But before we get to the matrix, the work-life matrix, talk about the three things that we need in order to succeed in today's economy. You say there are three things that we all need, and then we'll lead into the work-life matrix.
Yeah, so definitely I think that you need a knowledge of yourself and your own goals. You know, you got to know your own heart to get what you want. And then you also have to know what's going on in your industry so that you don't get painted into a corner and you don't get boxed in. And you also have to know what's going on with the larger economy. You know, you can't pretend that what's going on in the economy at large doesn't matter to you. At this point, you know, if China, you know, catches a cold, we're at least going to sneeze in the American economy. And there's entire towns that have had their economies lifted and, you know, bankrupted by international trade. So to a certain extent, you have to pay attention to the big picture.
So you ask these four questions and you develop these 16 archetypes.
Why don't we give out the phone number again first?
Then okay, we'll start on go this. Ahead.
Our phone number, 1-800-743-9576, if you'd like to join in. Also, email, that's radio@wlrn.org.
Okay, so first, how did you develop this work-life matrix, and how did you pick these four questions?
Well, I started doing the reporting for this book first. You know, this book took quite a while, and so I started interviewing people first and seeing what differentiated how they worked in the workplace. You know, so I would be talking to someone who was a CEO, and then I'd be talking to someone who was like a long-term middleman in a company. And so I saw these four different, you know, traits or inflection points. One is, how much risk were you willing to take? Another one was, did you want to do high social impact work? Did you want to make decisions alone or in a team, regardless of who executed those decisions? And finally, were you an innovator who loved, you know, coming up with new projects, or were you someone who liked finishing those projects and saying, you know, victory is the moment where we get to the finish line and you're an executor? And so I started with the reporting first, and then I did a bunch of survey research to refine kind of what questions I was asking and what I was learning from them. And I came up with, you know, some very distinct learning about 16 different archetypes from these surveys, and was able to, not surprisingly, find things like entrepreneurialism tracked with people who were more likely to be risk takers. But then, you know, one of the things I found out that really was enlightening to me personally was that people who did mission-driven work, you know, saying, I want to be a great journalist, or I want to, you know, educate children, or whatever it is.
Change the world. Actually
exactly. Change the world in one way or the other.
Right.
We're less happy than people who were, you know, just working for money. And at first I thought, that's weird. And then And then it made sense. I was like, okay, well, if you're doing mission-driven work, your mission is never done. No matter what that mission is, it's probably big enough. If it's big enough to be important enough to be a mission, it's also probably big enough to never quite be done.
You might be losing sleep over it or something.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, right. And, you know, and then if you're someone who says, well, I have to earn whatever amount of money a year, you know when you've hit your target. It doesn't mean you won't change your target, but at least you know when you've hit your target. And so things like this really speak a lot to human nature. And so much of what I, you know, I'm not trying to recreate some of the great career books like What Color Is Your Parachute? But what I'm trying to do is give people a different way based on reporting and you know, survey research to understand how we think and how we work.
Well, we took your test this morning.
Well, first of all, Farai, what are you?
Well, I'm an RHIT, which is means of risk-taking, high social impact, innovator, and likes making team decisions. And that's something called the promoter, which is like you're promoting an idea of the social welfare or the social good.
Well, I'm a CPIS, and Bonnie, be careful how you say this.
Oh, I'm a CHIT.
That's great. Well, did they resonate with you, or did you find them to be just weird?
Yeah, I think so.
No, I think they resonated. The only thing that occurred to me is, you know, we're living in such an uncertain time, so somebody gets the book and they find out, you know, their work-life matrix. But when you're talking about having to, a probably big majority of people have to worry about having a roof over their head and their next meal for them and or their families, you know, how can it help them to know themselves when they have to get that money to pay their rent?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is, just because you know what you prefer doesn't mean you can always have it. Like, maybe right. You're someone who prefers to have shrimp every night for dinner, but you know you can't afford it. So I'm not suggesting that this is the be-all and end-all, but I know that for many people, when they feel like they're working against their own self-interest, they begin to act out in this very, you know, understandably human but sort of childish way, which is like, I hate my job, you know, I can't, you know, blah, 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 moan, moan, moan. And so in order to avoid some of that, it does help even to know when you're making compromises. Like, okay, well, I'm just doing, this job is probably not a good long-term fit for me, but I'm going to do it for, you know, at least 6 to 12 months because I need to fill up the coffers and I'm really lucky to have this job. And, you know, it's going to be better for me to look from this than it is to look from being unemployed.
Right.
You know, you can actually make a win out of a compromise. And I think that that's something, you know, it's like I think about my grandfather who at one point had a wife, my grandmother, a child, and was making $13 a week as a candy delivery boy on a bicycle. You know, that's not a super, right. Even accounting for inflation, that's not a super great job. But he did it because he had a family, and I'm sure it was not, I know it was not his dream job. And he worked his way out of it and up from it. And so sometimes it helps to just say, well, this is what I got to do right now, but I still have a compass. This is what my compass is pointing towards. And I think it can be very difficult when you feel like, you know, that you've lost your compass. Sometimes that's worse than knowing that you can't follow your compass right then, because, you know, life is kind of like a winding mountain pass. Sometimes you have to, you know, do a little winding around to get to the top. And so there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that you have to understand where you're really headed and what you really want.
We get an emailer. Laura says, this discussion is spot on with me because I've held positions for about 4 years each time. I have the hardest time with not feeling like I did succeed or my career is not successful, even though I'm definitely contributing to society almost more than some of the longer career people are.
Yeah. I mean, I would say to Laura, definitely, it sounds like you're someone who is doing actually quite well in, you know, this environment. But, you know, maybe you are still thinking that you have to be successful on the traditional model's terms, meaning, you know, 25 years at a job, in order to be successful. So sometimes it's really just about redefining success and saying that, you know, staying employed, staying flexible, staying nimble is the new version of success. It's not about whether or not you are at the same place forever. Because no one can tell you what success is for you except you. And if there's some old programming there, or if, you know, people are making you feel a certain way, sometimes you just have to drop that.
I know other generations kind of get tired of hearing about the boomers, but how about some advice for boomers in these new work realities?
Yeah, the situation for boomers is actually really important to talk about, because the reality is that the younger you are, the less you earn in general, but also the shorter the time of unemployment. And as you get older, if you become unemployed, the average length of unemployment becomes quite long. So people who are 50 and above who become unemployed are right now unemployed for an average of 53 weeks. So that's nearly a year. And considering that most people don't have enough money to last more than a month without savings, you know, without additional savings, a year is a devastating amount of time to be without money. And so one of the things I really talk about is the need to really sort of cut long-term unemployment off at the pass. There are certain risks to taking a job that is, quote, beneath you, but there's a lot of risk to becoming long-term unemployed. It's better to find a good enough job for the moment and then look for a better job from that good enough job than it is to become someone who says, I'm never going to work for below X amount of money. And I talk about this nonstop in the book in many different places, because a lot of us have this idea that if we've earned X amount in the past, we need to earn X amount plus whatever in the future. And sometimes, again, it's like the mountain road. You have to have a switchback. You have to double back and then move forward again.
So if you're old, but so if you're older, you better not make waves and better not say, take this job and shove it until you've got something something to fall back on.
Well, you know, it
depends,
it's something,
right?
If you say take this job and shove it, you better be prepared to get another job relatively quickly, or you should be someone who has a lot of savings.
Yeah.
So you can say that, and it's not about just, you know, being silent and just suffering in silence. It's about saying, well, what's my plan? You know, if this job that I'm in is one where I just can't take it anymore, and sometimes that's the case, then what's my bridge? You know, I might not be able to find the perfect job right away, but if I have to leave where I am now and I know that I'm not ready to take the next dream job, what's the bridge in between? Don't step out without a bridge. You know, I really do believe that.
We're speaking with Farai Jadeja. She is an award-winning author, political journalist, researcher, cultural analyst, and educator. She's a distinguished writer in residence at NYU's Journalism Institute, and she's written The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. If you'd like to speak with Farai, how do you see your career in light of new employment dynamics? Have you changed jobs frequently, like our last emailer, because of employment uncertainty or for other reasons? Call us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN.
Farai, in today's realm, how about the best way to find a job? It appears, at least by reading from your book, that online really isn't the place to put a lot of your chips.
Well, it's more that online is a great complement. You don't want to use online as the only search tool. And so this is, you know, the book is very practical. And I wanted it to be that way on purpose, because I feel like there's just so much going on. People need really straightforward, practical advice. And so, you know, as it turns out, the online job search is, without a lot of other context, it can be a real waste of time. That's not true for certain fields, like if you're a computer programmer, or there's certain fields where you can use credentials that work easily online to find a job. But in general, what you want to do is use networking as your primary base and really work the outer edges of your network, what's called weak ties. there's a lot of research that shows that people who are closest to you may be the most loyal, but people who are on the edges of your circle actually have the freshest job leads because they know things you don't, you know? And so there may be people who you haven't spoken to in a while, or people who are members of your church or other faith community, or your high school or college alumni association, mm-hmm. and you just reach out to that wide circle. And you have to be open and you have to be willing to say, I'm looking for a job. But once you kind of put it out there, you'd be surprised at how successful that strategy is as opposed to just sitting online. And I think that there's something, you know, it's not that online job search is bad in and of itself, but there is a way that I talk about that people can mistake the time they spend on the computer for time that they're actually looking for a job. It's like if you're playing Candy Crush or Solitaire or whatever it is, you're not looking for a job, you know? And it's easy to drift off, you know, and start doing something else that's just not actually that useful.
So you're not saying online is not the way to go. You're just saying that you have to couple that with networking.
You have to couple online with networking. And you also have to be sensitive to the field you're in. Because, like, some fields, you know, are really great with online job search, ones where you tend to have credentials that register really well online. Like, I know this computer program, or I can use this search engine optimization tool. But then other things require a different way of expressing how qualified you are, and online may not be the best way to
go. Farai, what about in this slash career or hopscotch, whichever it is, in this 4.5 years lifespan, it requires sometimes that you have to get additional training or education. And I'm thinking, you know, there are ways, I guess, you can get the education. You suggest a lot of them that you can get additional education for very little or no charge. But I'm thinking of, if not financial constraints for some, time constraints.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, this is one of the biggest questions about our work world today, which is how do you, in a world where lifelong learning is really not, you know, an option, it's a demand, how do you deal with that? And again, you know, I have stories in the book of people like a guy who went back to school full time at night while working full time during the day. And he had two kids and his wife was pregnant with their third, and he was, you know, sort of in between jobs, working a job that he didn't really want to work. And now he's doing extremely well, but he really had to put the burn on, and he didn't have time. He made time. And there's going to be moments like that where that's your best option. There are certainly a lot of free online classes in certain fields. Some of the technology industries, and programming, there's a lot of free online classes. And then even when there's not free online classes, there's, I list some federal job resources in the back. There's, you know, skills retraining. There's also, community colleges that have fairly reasonable rates to get new skills. So with everything today, you have to balance the cost and the benefits. And so you have to decide for yourself when investing the time and money is the right thing to do, and when sort of guarding your energy is something that you have to do, because it's not always the right time to retrain. But in general, if you just sort of count on the skills you have today keeping you employed tomorrow, that may not work out.
And it's time for listeners. First up, we've got Freddie in Miami. Hey, Freddie.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you all, and I appreciate...
Hi, Freddie.
I've been listening to the conversation from the early start, and I would just like to ask your guest where it is that you get the facts that the Great Recession only lasted for 1 year. That can be so misleading when I've seen in a lifespan of 10 years an economic giant dwindle into the garbage can. And that's just globally also.
Oh, I think, Freddie, I think you may have misunderstood something. Farai, that's not exactly...
Well, yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, Freddie. I mean, I said that it technically ended in in 2009, but that's because that's the way that it's defined federally. So I agree with you that the Great Recession...
That is the way it is being marketed to the public, and it's not real. I mean, housing is up, education is up, healthcare is up, unaffordable, never mind about the word up. And yet when I listen to you as a researcher, you know, you make the comment that the Great Recession is only a lifespan of 1 year. That is ridiculous.
Well, I really don't think
I didn't say it was 1 year, but I did say it ended in 2009 because, again, I'm using the federal definition of what a recession is. I also do think, though, to your point, that there's a lot of, you know, sort of there's a lot of flawed accounting in how we look at something like the impact of a recession or even how we look at the unemployment rate, like the unemployment rate as it's stated today is one of several different figures that the Department of Labor comes up with. And I actually think that a different figure would be the one that I would prefer to have us use that is a better reflection of what are called discouraged workers, people who have stopped looking for work. So the long story short is I agree that it's very the way that we look at economics can be restrictive, but I try to use the terms that the federal government does and put a caveat with them rather than ignore how they're used in the popular discourse.
Right. Okay. Let's move along. We'll take another caller. This is Jesus in Miami. Hi there.
Hi. It's great to be here. I would like to ask, I've had like about six jobs perhaps in the last year and a half, 2 years. And then 6 months ago, I left the workforce to finish my education. So how does someone like me go from there?
To get back.
Thanks, Jesus. Right. Well, are you still on?
Yes.
Yeah.
What field are you in or trying to get in?
I'm only 21. I don't really know what to do with my life. However, no. I am into... looking into political science, economics, because I was always very good at the social sciences.
Okay. Well, that's great. I mean, I think that that's really good context because I think that depending on your age and depending on what you've studied, a bunch of different things open up. So first of all, because you're young and because you are open-minded, it sounds like, about different options in front of you, I would really use that broad set of networking skills. So wherever you went to school should have a career placement office. I would go sit down with them and just be like, look, you know, I want to talk to everyone who is doing economics, political science, et cetera, who is an alumni who might be willing to talk to me and give me an informational interview. And just see if you can get 15 minutes on the phone or face-to-face with people who are in the region who are doing things that might be interesting to you. You know, don't go in asking for a job, but you'd be surprised. Sometimes people, after having a conversation, will say, well, this is the kind of person who I really should refer. And, you know, maybe my friend is looking for someone to hire. But it's about putting your name out there and using this network you already have. So that network includes the career counseling office of wherever you're going to school. That network, again, includes friends and family and faith community, even sports community, you know, any kind of things that you do that are for passion. But it's about really looking broadly at, you know, pretty much starting from where you are at your age. There are so many different ladders that you could climb, and it doesn't matter as much which one you start climbing as that you find a good handhold.
Okay,
and so
Jose.
Look for people. Yeah.
Jesus,
so,
we
so
have to be
basically just look.
Sounds
yeah.
like good advice.
Yeah.
Hello?
Okay, Jesus, we have to run.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you
for your comment.
Thanks, Jesus. We're speaking with Farai Jadea. Her book is The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. We'll be right back after this break.
Mother's Day is right around the corner. Send her your love and support WLRN at the same time. Tune in May 3rd through May 6th to place your flower order through WLRN and our partners at Field of Flowers. For more, visit WLRN.org.
healthcare prices are complicated. However you pay for your healthcare, WLRN has an online guide called Price Check. It's a database of prices for common healthcare procedures and medical supplies. You can add your prices to the list, and we're asking for your help building the database. The more people who add their prices, the more useful the guide becomes. Price Check is a community-created database of healthcare prices. You can find it at wlrn.org/pricecheck.
Some 125,000 visually impaired adults live in Broward County, one of the highest rates in the nation. For over 43 years, Lighthouse of Broward has served the blind and visually impaired community at no charge. To learn, volunteer, donate, and change a life, visit lhob.org.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Farah Chidea. We're talking about her book, The Episodic Career. Faria, the common threads of the hundreds of interviews you've done for this book, well, what is it, fear?
Well, I think the common thread is anxiety, you know, not necessarily fear, but this sense that, you know, am I doing enough? Am I, fear, yes, anxiety mainly, and then also this sense of, is it okay to hope? Is it okay for me to hope that I will still have, you know, the opportunity to do better? Is it still okay for me to hope that I'll have a second act or a third act? And I think that in addition to all of the cautionary tales I offer, I do want to give people the sense that there is hope for many different acts, you know, that just because we're asked to be more adaptable and flexible does not mean that there aren't good times ahead. It does mean that, you know, you're going to have an easier time and a better time if you are open to more possibilities, and that sort of viewing your life as a kind of narrow funnel of what you can do is probably not going to bring you as much satisfaction as viewing your life as a set of possibilities that will change as the economy changes, as the country changes. You know, we just can't avoid the need to be adaptable right now, but that doesn't mean that we can't have a good life and that we can't find, I refuse to be either a Pollyanna or a pessimist. I think that life is hard and it requires hard work and adaptability, but there are many pleasures that we each can access.
I wanted to ask you, going back to the archetypes, was there one archetype that you found, because you talk about resilience, which is also what you're talking about now, as being so crucial in, you know, getting up and moving along if something doesn't work out. Did you find one archetype that was more resilient than the others?
I wouldn't put it that way. I didn't find that one archetype. No, but I mean, I think it's a fantastic question, but I think it's more that some archetypes are more kind of obviously resilient. So the empire builder, which is, you know, the archetype that is very entrepreneurial, a lot of CEOs, and the person who I interview as the archetype is the CEO of an insurance company. And he talks about how, in his mind, being an entrepreneur comes from this desire to say, well, the world could be better if we just did something this way. And that fundamental sense of optimism, which then gets tempered with the businessman's hard comeuppance, like, oh, well, you thought you could do it that way, but the world says you can't. And then having to find that strength and say, well, actually, maybe that wasn't such a great idea, but I have another one. And mm-hmm. willingness to get back in the ring. And I think that that takes place on a grand scale, you know, for the empire builder, but for everyone, it's really that willingness to get back in the ring, no matter whether, you know, the ring is starting a new company or whether it's starting a new job as, you know, someone doing what is considered by others to be a menial task. I mean, another thing that I've really learned is that pride in work is something that is not restricted to any one class of job. You can have a really fancy job and have no pride in your work, and you can have a job that's not considered fancy and have an incredible work ethic and pride. And I think that there are also reasons for us to look at how we approach work in these deeply psychological ways and that are not necessarily, you know, seen as much on our bank balance, but that provide us with a rewarding experience.
Next up, we'll take another caller. We've got Bob in Fort Lauderdale. Bob, we're a little short on time, so please be succinct if you would.
Sure. When I grew up in the 60s, people talked about retiring and never working. Now, as I'm approaching retirement, I and a lot of people my age now talk about transitioning to a part-time retirement job. Can Verizon talk a little bit about that, please?
Absolutely. And I know we don't have a lot of time, but labor force participation rates for people who are 65 plus have been going up year over year for both men and women. And so you're seeing, you know, it be about 13% for women in their 70s now and 20 plus percent for men in their early 70s. So, yes, the idea of part-time work as a healthy part of retirement is growing, but also, unfortunately, for some people, that part-time work comes out of economic anxiety. So it's always a matter of stacking the deck so that you have the choice.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, listen, Farai, you had some really inspirational stories in your book, and I was going to go there and ask you to share some favorites, but I think that we're just going to have to tell our listeners that if they want to read the stories, the name of the book is The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption, because we can't, I'd be remiss if we let you go. You've covered every presidential election since 1996. So do you mind if I ask what your thoughts are on this one?
Yeah, no, I would love to. I mean, that's a lot of what I do for 538. I think that barring unforeseen circumstances, and that says a lot because there are many, I think that it will be a Clinton-Trump race. And I think that after this election, the country will have a lot of fence mending to do internally. You know, regardless of who wins, I think that the reality is that we've had a big upheaval in how we think of ourselves as a nation, and we're going to have to do some work on that.
That's it?
Where would Donald Trump fit into the work-life matrix? That'd be fascinating.
He's an empire builder.
Absolutely. So, Farai, give us some contact information and this 538. And you also have a Facebook page now for the Episodic Career, right?
Yeah. If you just go to, you know, it's Facebook.com/ The Episodic Career or Episodic Career. And also my Twitter is Farai, F-A-R-A-I, my first name. My website is the same thing, Farai.com. And, you know, I'm always happy to answer emails or provide resources to people who reach out to me.
Farai Chadayan, an award-winning author, political journalist, researcher, cultural analyst, and educator. She's a distinguished writer-in-residence at NYU's Journalism Institute.
All those with a slash.
All those with a
slash,
right. And her book, it's a fascinating book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. Well, thanks so much, Farai. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bonnie and Joseph.
And that wraps up today's program. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Michael Stock. Paul Leary is off today. Polly Landis is associate producer. And don't forget about our free audio downloads of all our programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. And, of course, more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Also, photos of our staff and studios. So join us for tomorrow's program, especially if you're a condo or homeowners association member. We'll get the latest in development from attorney, association specialist, and regular contributor, Donna Berger. Could there be election fraud in your association? We'll learn about the indicators. Also, what's with so many units reporting unexplained water leaks? Where's that water coming from? That's Topical Currents tomorrow at your service. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Our apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.